On the record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
Plenty to get through today because there's lots in the papers and lots to come up on the show. So I'll head straight into today's Sunday newspapers, and we'll start with the Sunday Independent, because if you were getting optimistic about the government's plans to tackle the chronic housing shortage, then things are going to get worse before they get better, frankly, because the Sunday Independent tells us today that the cost of buying a home is likely to hit double-digit growth this year for the first time since the Celtic Tiger era. New data from the Institute of Professional Auctioneers and Valuers shows that house prices rose nationally by 6.25% between January and June, and increases are expected to hit double that by the end of the year compared with last year. Yesterday, the Housing Minister, Dara O'Brien, told the Sunday Independent, "That's not a good result. I don't want to see double-digit house prices. That's not something that any state or any property market can sustain." The piece goes on to tell us, by the way, that Waterford and Limerick saw prices grow by more than 10% in the first 6 months of the year. The cost of a four-bed semi-detached home increased by more than 9% in 13 other regions, as recent trends show that the advent of remote working means house hunters are now prioritising space over location. Mr. Davitt, who is the chief executive of the IPAV, said, "We are on course for increases of around 12%. By the end of the year." Also on the front page of the Sunday Independent this morning, we learn that a third of the Cabinet's ministers are using an encrypted messaging service that allows conversations to disappear. The piece names Heather Humphreys, Pascal Donoghue, Eamon Ryan, Catherine Martin, Roderick O'Gorman, Pippa Hackett and Stephen Donnelly as all being users of the Signal messaging app, which is specifically advertised so as to delete messages after a certain period of time. Although it should be said that there is no assertion in that piece that they actually use that app for conducting government business, because obviously, if they did, then there'd be question marks about whether records are being retained for freedom of information. On that note, the front page of the Sunday Times this morning tells us that Simon Coveney, the Foreign Affairs Minister, will be quizzed at an Oireachtas committee on Tuesday if he deleted texts with Leo Varadkar from his phone after freedom of information requests were submitted by journalists. It is an offence punishable by a fine of up to €4,000 to destroy a record, which is the subject of a request under FOI legislation. We're told that Coveney must also explain to the committee why he deleted texts from the Taoiseach about the appointment of Catherine Zappone to a UN role, despite keeping messages from Zappone from the same period on his phone. If this is all a little bit confusing to you as regard timelines, there is an explanation further down the article which might be a little bit more helpful. The Sunday Times submitted an FOI request to Coveney's department seeking all internal records relating to the post, including Coveney's personal correspondence, on the evening of July the 28th, and that was the very evening that the Cabinet signed off on this and in which there was some disquiet known about it. Piers Doherty, who is Sinn Féin's finance spokesman, submitted a similar FOI request on July the 30th, but it was, if not stated explicitly, certainly intimated by Simon Coveney at the Foreign Affairs Committee last Tuesday that he had deleted messages on his phone for security reasons, and they'd like to know whether he had actually deleted the messages after a request went in to receive them. And we're also told, in a quote from Piers Doherty, that the Minister can't bluntly state that he's destroying government records. He's been a member of Cabinet for 10 years, and there's been many FOI requests relating to his phone records in that time, so he knows he is legally obliged to retain them. That's the front page of the Sunday Times this morning. The Business Post leads with another housing story. Government loses 10,000 affordable homes amid fears of a legal backlash. So with all the talk about the number of affordable homes that's going to be delivered under the Housing for All plan, we're told that the government has lost the opportunity to secure 10,000 additional affordable homes from developers because it granted a last-minute exemption to large swathes of land from a key provision of the new Housing for All. So as it stands now, some developers will be told that they have to set aside 20% of all homes for social and affordable housing. Previously, it was only 10% for social, and there was actually no obligation to provide affordable units at all. It's now going to be the case that you have to provide 10% for social and 10% for affordable, but there's an exemption so that anyone who bought land between 2015 and 2021 won't have to meet it. And that's because the government is fearful of legal cases from people who have bought land and it now turn out that they can't make quite as much profit as they believed. And also, those who secure planning permission within the next 5 years are going to be exempt as well. So maybe quite a few houses which could have been built if the government had been more assertive with its lawmaking, maybe not going to be delivered because the government is worried about legal cases being taken by the developers who own that land. By the way, Killian Woods, who wrote that piece, also has another piece on the front page, who says that the owners of vacant pubs, vacant homes, face a potential fivefold hike to their annual property tax. Ireland has an estimated 180,000 vacant properties that could potentially be used for housing, and now the government is to set about some sort of survey to figure out exactly which ones are abandoned or derelict and which ones are maybe lying idle because their occupiers are in the Fair Deal scheme or something like that. But certainly higher taxes coming down the way. And finally, for now, on the front pages this morning, the Irish Mail on Sunday last week, it led with a story about a WhatsApp group which featured the Green Party TD Brian Leddon and some misogynistic comments that were included in that. It says this morning that the Green Party TD Brian Leddon has been dragged into fresh controversy over his WhatsApp group after a screen grab detailing another instance of an anti-female slur emerged. And these new details come as six Green Party colleagues, including the party's deputy leader Catherine Leddon, strongly condemned not only Mr. Leddon's inaction in the face of the original comments, but also the lack of sanction from the party. There's a piece, a quote from Catherine Martin, as we know, the party's deputy leader. She says, "The language included in that Limerick WhatsApp group, as reported last week, was disgusting, insulting, demeaning and misogynistic. And as I said to members of the party's management committee and to Brian himself on Sunday, silence is an enabler in such scenarios and it shouldn't be excused." She says that she respects the will of the executive committee, which has chosen not to pursue any kind of disciplinary proceedings against him. But she says, "As a female member in a leadership position in this party, I'm disappointed and frustrated by the lack of understanding and the hurt caused and the perceived trivialising by the party of serious issues which impact women." Also similar comments from the party's finance spokeswoman, Nessa Harrigan, who says that the WhatsApp messages involved derogatory and misogynistic language used in a semi-public forum. So that's your whistle-stop tour of what's on the front pages of this morning's newspapers. We're joined in studio by Christina Finn, who's the political correspondent with the journal.ie, and by Fergus Finlay, columnist with the Irish Examiner and a member of the HSE's board of directors. Thank you both for coming in. We'll start with housing matters, because I think in any other week this would be the story to end all stories. There is an awful lot written about it, Christina. Where do you want to start?
Yeah, I think pretty depressing reading there about the possible double-digit hike for house prices. I think everyone was quite optimistic. Well, I know I certainly was trying to be when this Housing for All plan was launched earlier this week. There are some good measures in there, but there does seem to be, from my point of view, I think, sort of a lack of urgency, I think, within this plan. Obviously, it's a massive plan to span out a number of years, but I think we've heard over the last number of years, last number of months about COVID and how we've been quick to act and how things can actually get done by the state when we really want them to. And there's a number of things, I think, picked out by the newspapers today just to show, you know, great plans, you know, good intentions, but the wheels of motion in terms of when these things are actually going to deliver any real impact for people seems to be a long way off.
Was it ever going to be any other way, though? Because we know that it's coming from a little bit of a standing start, that housing division or provision, even for last year, wasn't quite what it ought to have been because there was subsequent lockdowns, and this year is probably going to be the same. But we know that we don't have this massive dormant industry. We don't have massive numbers of block layers, for example, sitting around waiting for work. They're all busy anyway. So it was never going to hit top gear from day one.
Yeah, I think that's picked up a lot in the papers about the lack of construction workers and mention of visas being given to non-EU citizens in terms of getting ramping up that workforce. But just one aspect, I think, and it's not really mentioned that much in the papers, is the issue of renting. And yes, the plan has a cost rental plan, one that we haven't really seen before. But I think at the press conference there at the housing minister earlier this week, there was very much the focus on home ownership and saying that everyone in Ireland has, you know, an aim for home ownership. I think everyone kind of knows there is something within us that we like to own our own property, and that seems to be the goal. But that doesn't mean that you should just totally leave off the rental sector and allow them to just, you know, pay to the hilt. Because I think there should have been perhaps quicker measures perhaps brought in for the rental sector. Cost rental, great, but you know, we saw that the first cost rental provision that was brought in this year was absolutely like floored with the amount of applications for it.
Understandably.
Yeah, and then we see that obviously with people working at home, they're moving out. Myself, I lived in Dublin for 10 years. I've moved out to the Royal County, your own there, Gavin, in the last year. Fine spot, exactly. Just because, yeah, rents. That's basically what it comes down to, and the rising cost of them. And I think Sinn Féin, they'll be pointing to some of their, perhaps what people would say are quick fixes for the rental sector. The rent credit, I think that was something that we had a number of years ago. Yes, it wouldn't have made a massive impact to someone's wallet, but it would perhaps give them back 1,200 euro or so within a year that they've paid an extortionate amount of money on rent.
Well, Fergus Findlay, what do you make of that? Because immediately the thought strikes me that if it's going to take a few years for this housing provision to really get up to top gear the way the government intends, and by the way, there are separate questions around whether top gear is actually ambitious enough, and we'll maybe come back to that, but certainly will with John Moran later in the programme. But if it's going to take a few years for all that housing to be delivered, then a lot of people are going to be looking at potentially being able to afford homes and getting mortgages relatively late in life, at which point their mortgage repayments might be so high that it might actually be very difficult to do that. So if there is an oversight for the rental generation, then it's going to be something that does have lifelong consequences.
There's no doubt about that. I think the first thing I'd like to say is that I think it's really in all our interest that this plan works. I mean, I was kind of excited when I saw it. I'm kind of disappointed by all the dissing of it that has gone on.
Why so?
I mean, I think...
Why so?
Because we need it to work. Because we absolutely need it to work. I mean, I listened to Eoin O'Brien, for example, for whom I have huge respect, his ability and so on. Every question he was asked, he prefaced his answer by saying, the problem with this is... And he proceeded then to dismantle every single aspect of the plan. Now,
but is that not only the prerogative of opposition, but rather the duty of opposition? Yeah,
of course it is. Of course it is. I'm not saying he's not entitled to do it.
If the plan isn't ambitious enough, then it's not going to work.
Well, I don't, at one level, what I want to see is movement. I work in communities that are disadvantaged by housing issues primarily. They desperately need to see rapid movement. I'm also aware of communities where there are plans in place and where, I wouldn't say quite shovel ready, but certainly very close to shovel ready projects are ready to go once given the green light. And I want that green light to shine as brightly as it possibly can.
Is there anything in what you've seen in the plans in the last couple of days that will expedite that green light, that will get shovels in ground quicker?
Well, it's not so much in the plan. It's more in the interaction between local authorities and the department. My experience over the last number of years has been that local authorities have been starved of resources, starved of capacity. Even if they have a big parcel of land that they can develop, they don't have the architects, they don't have the planners, they don't have the back office, as it were, capacity to do it. That's a problem that is a fixable problem, if not overnight, then certainly in a matter of weeks. I know of projects where if the department said go, local authorities are ready to go. And I hope that this plan and the structures around it, the interdepartmental structures that are being set up and run by the Taoiseach's department, I hope they zero in on those kind of things. Because what people need is quick wins. We need to see real progress. When you drive around Dublin, there are cranes everywhere. There are masses of people involved in construction. A lot of them are building the wrong stuff. They're building office blocks and they're building retail parks and so on.
And they're building hotels.
And they're building hotels. And they're not building the houses that we need. And then you drive through a place like Cherrywood and you see painfully slow progress. It was effectively shut down for most of the COVID period, and it's painfully slow when you see it. So what I really want is, whatever the plan says, I want political will and drive behind it to make things happen. Well, and I know they're not going to happen overnight. I know we can't, put plasterers and block layers and electricians to work in the morning. But you need to see bits and pieces of progress. You need to see cranes starting to appear over housing sites.
You just made an interesting observation there, though, about interdepartmental structures and all of this and whole of government approaches. And of course, everyone wants there to be whole of government approaches because nobody wants there to be one department batting against another. Everyone wants to have everyone moving in the same direction. But you have a bit of experience of how the inner machinery of government works as a former chef de cabinet for the Labour Party and coalition in the 1990s. Sometimes I wonder whether all of government approaches are actually just another byword for additional levels of bureaucracy, which makes it even harder to get closer to a green light.
They can be. I can give you instances of that. I could stay here for the next 2 hours talking about
the
problems with interdepartmental committees. An interdepartmental committee is very often a place where people come together to fight their own corner.
Well, it's a forum for more people to raise concerns.
Yeah, but sometimes, I mean, I can remember an occasion in the 80s where Gareth Fitzgerald virtually single-handedly delivered a national roads plan by forcing an interdepartmental committee to produce a plan and get to work by calling them together every Monday morning, by insisting that the highest level of the department was present and so on. I mean, I can remember when you have that kind of leadership. I can, like, in the 70s, in the 60s, in the 70s, in the 80s, we had ministers in Ireland who wanted to build houses. That's what they wanted. One that I will never forget is a long-forgotten minister called Jimmy Tully, who went into the Department of the Environment and said, I want to build houses.
He's not now, that he's forgotten for people who pay attention to constituency boundaries. He's not forgotten.
Remembered, he's remembered for bad stuff as well as good stuff, fairly or unfairly. But his track record in building houses was one of somebody who drove progress, right? Who drove quality and who drove progress. And that's what you need now. I mean, I hope Dara O'Brien is the Jimmy Tully of today. He won't be doing constituency boundaries. Let him just build houses.
It'll be up to him shortly.
I do think
Christina.
People want, obviously, this plan to succeed. There's no doubt about it. I think the Rebuilding Ireland plan was full of big promises and very
wasn't
much
driven. Wasn't driven.
I remember the minister responsible for it always talking about how he was going to butt heads and convene all these housing summits and really try to, you know, break through all the bureaucracy, and it never quite seemed to
happen. And I think now there seems to be a real realisation, and I think very much so at the last general election when Fine Gael were banging on about Brexit and the economy, and they were met very much so with the housing issues of today on the doorsteps. But for one aspect for me, like, and it's picked up there in the Sunday Business Post in relation to the vacant property tax, that was only a couple of lines really in the Housing for All plan. It was saying, you know, we're going to get the local property tax measures in and then we'll look to bring in some form of vacant tax. It had to be teased.
But it was quite aspirational. It wasn't very explicit.
It wasn't very explicit. It had to be teased out within that press conference with Dara O'Brien. But interesting to see that if it is brought in, that you're talking about possibly 5,000 to 7,000 per unit. What strikes me is the number of examples we've seen over the last year written by the Sunday Business Post, that big apartment block down by Grand Canal Dock, which has 190 apartments and 100 of them were vacant. So if you're talking about 7,000, that's a lot of money per unit for some sort of vulture fund to have to pay out, whether that's a disincentive or whether that would actually hit them depending on what's on their balance book. But it's those sort of, I think, actions that will bring on perhaps, or at least fill some sort of the gap. If you're talking about the amount of vacant properties we have, those things are built. They're, you know, if we can actually get them fitted out, you know, those apartment blocks are sitting there idle.
One of the really interesting things, though, is the number of elements of the plan that are cautious and made cautious by fear of legal reprisal, as it were.
Like the front page story in the Business Post today.
Like the front page story in the Business Post. Like you know, the whole business of troubling property tax. It only takes one legal action to stop everything. And that's why I'm kind of surprised that they haven't already put together the wording for a constitutional referendum. We need a better balance in the constitution between the public good and property rights.
It does seem very long-fingered, that, doesn't it, Christina? They've been talking about that for years, and there is a commitment to it inside the programme for government. But if it seems like...
And there's wording available.
And if it seems like the delivery of at least 10,000 affordable homes, which the government has now decided to opt away from because of this amendment that Cillian Woods is drawing attention to on page one today, it seems like the sort of thing where maybe if you really wanted to make it feel like Housing for All was going to be this real barricade of a plan, this real battering ram, that you would include the wording for something like that alongside it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's been talked about for a long time, but, you know, it was back and forth even when it was under discussions before. And you've got information about who was in favour of and who was not. I think something like that would really perhaps put a good bit of weight behind it. I know Dara O'Brien's setting up a housing commission, I think it is, where it's going to discuss, you know, the future plans for Ireland over the next 20 or 30 years, so beyond this plan. But I think for people at home, they really need the feeling that this plan has the weight of the government behind it, because we can just point to Rebuilding Ireland to see how stuff can radically...
You can go back further. I mean, sometime at the start of the Celtic Tiger, public policy in Ireland decided that housing was a commodity, and a commodity on which as much profit as possible was to be made, and all housing was to be the preserve of the private sector. And we virtually abandoned public housing at that stage. We turned it all over to the private sector. And the other thing that happened then, and it's happening again, if that survey is correct, those figures that you were quoting earlier, Gavin, we turned the law of supply and demand on its head. The more houses we built, the more expensive they became, which is kind of nutty. And it does seem as if we're running that risk again, that we're going to build loads and loads of houses and they're going to be really, really expensive. We've got to fix that. And you can't fix that if, in the mindset, housing is a commodity. Housing has to be seen as something that is not a commodity, but a human right.
Well, I've another question on that, although Maria has just tweeted in a very sage observation. You know, you're telling us that local authorities are starved of resources. Maria points out that it's 10 years on from the introduction of residential local property tax, which was supposed to provide local authorities with all of these resources, and it's clearly never materialised. There's one question that still jumps...
It's cash. You know that.
But there's one question that still jumps out for me as of all of this, which is the presumption that if you supply more housing, that the cost and therefore the level of affordability of housing comes down, which wasn't true in the Celtic Tiger when we were delivering 90,000 or 100,000 homes a year. And I don't understand why it would be true now when we plan at best to maybe deliver half of that number.
Because in the Celtic Tiger years, it was a commodity. Land was a commodity. If you got your land rezoned for residential purposes, the value of your land quintupled or sextupled. And it's the value of land that more than any other factor determines the value of housing. So that is a fixable problem.
Noble Guardian on Twitter says Micheál Martin has a point about the overuse of judicial review, especially in communities who have the means and the sense of entitlement to deploy it. We don't have the right to stop others living in our communities where the space does exist to communicate them. I said before the break that it's very difficult to try and summarise the whole Catherine Tupou, Simon Coveney story, and I don't even know how you'd go about trying to explain it to a newcomer or a relative abroad who now needs to be debriefed on the whole thing. Suffice to say that Simon Coveney is due to publish a file relating to the appointment of Catherine Tupou by the Department of Foreign Affairs tomorrow, and he's due himself before an Oireachtas committee this coming Tuesday. In a large sense, Christina, because the first time that he went in front of the committee last week, he said stuff which either conflicted with or didn't quite address some of the stuff that had been said previously.
Yeah, so this is a very confusing story. I haven't really kept up over it for the last number of weeks, but basically where we're at now is the spotlight is very much on Simon Coveney. What he said in the committee meeting last week, particularly about the deletion of text messages from his phone relating to the Tupou appointment, as well as him mentioning some sort of hacking of his phone as well, seems to be being questioned by a lot of the opposition, and why
that's
that wasn't
angle I'd forgotten about.
Exactly, yeah. That why it wasn't reported or why it wasn't investigated, or if it was, why didn't we know about it? So I think, yeah, next week, it'll be very much whether this is going to be put to bed or not. It's very much down to Simon Coveney, I think, and what he says on Tuesday and what exactly is in that file.
What would put it to bed then? Because you might, for the benefit of listeners whose eyes are beginning to glaze over all this already, can you outline some of the outstanding issues and what could be done to put them all to bed?
Well, for me, it never ceases to amaze me, I think, how they manage to get themselves into these kerfuffles and don't think about, oh, maybe if I delete text messages, this might be a problem. Or, you know, the appointment itself, you know, the constant talk about cronyism and putting people that you know into these jobs. I think there should be, if they come out and say that they're going to do something with this UN envoy job, which is very much just sort of sitting there in the ether, I think the government, if they're going to try and, you know, spin this, that it's actually a job that they wanted to fill, they're going to need to fill it, like, fairly quickly.
Yeah. We've only got another 3.5 weeks as the chair of the Security Council, so if they really want to exploit that, they're going to have to move very quickly.
Very quickly. And I think we've had the constant talk about Tupou being the best person for the job, and I don't think anyone was really questioning her qualifications or whether she would have been. But the whole point is we don't know that because nobody else got to apply. So I think moving on that particular job, trying to fill it as best you can, but then also being clear about, I think Coveney is probably going to have to come out and say something about the text messages, his procedure in which he deletes them. But I don't think it's very much a surprise for a lot of people, I think, particularly in the media, about freedom of information, text messages, WhatsApp. It's a whole different ball game than it was 20 years ago, where everything was written down in notes or, you know, posted and all the rest. Well, now there's so many lines of communication. But I think the FOI Act Yes, this is sort of a, you know, a wonky discussion, I suppose, but it speaks to a larger transparency within government.
This is the lack thereof. Isn't it a very worthy topic, but which doesn't necessarily excite the pulses of many people who might be more interested in an ongoing chat about the housing plan, for example, than whether ministers are in full dot the I's, cross the T's compliance?
Yeah, but what I would say
laws.
To people is a lot of the things that you read in newspapers and a lot of things that are unearthed that do matter to people's everyday lives often come from Freedom of Information Act. And quite frankly, over the last number of years, there have been just the sheer lack of compliance to it. We've seen there about FOI requests going in. Mm. Most journalists now try and put an overarching thing on their request where they'll be saying, I want the information to do with emails, correspondence, letters, memos,
you,
WhatsApp.
You have to be explicit or else you never get them. But now it turns out as
it
a result of all this week, that in this particular instance where there was FOI requests from certainly at least two journalists at the Irish Times who had specifically asked for text messages exchanged between X and Y over a certain topic, they were told back, oh, we've had a full look and we can't find any such records. And it turns out that they had never asked for Leo Varadkar's phone in the first place, which makes it very difficult to fulfil any request. And it does kind of bulldoze your faith in whether they're ever releasing the things that you're asking for.
Yeah, and then I think in the background to that, the release of the text messages from Leo Varadkar last week, which was kind of a unprecedented move. It's very rare for, you know, ministers just to hand over their text messages, particularly with all sort of smiley faces and emojis and all the rest in them. But some people are reading into that was some sort of slight or, you know, you know, that the relationship between Simon Coveney and Leo Varadkar perhaps isn't as on the best footing as it should be. But that would obviously be all speculation to where that is right now. I think Coveney does have to go in. I think sometimes he might have a tendency to be a bit, you know, why are you asking me this question? Why is this important? I don't think that sort of air should come across in the committee by any means at the point we're at now. But I do think there needs to be kind of clear, concise answers. And be it that he says, mea culpa, I shouldn't have done this, then that should be said.
There's a fair amount written in today's papers about all of this, Fergus. Where do you want to start?
Well, first of all, it shouldn't have been written, shouldn't happen.
Which bit shouldn't happen?
This is a problem entirely created by government ministers. They've created a rod for their own backs to be beaten by. It's a self-inflicted wound of the most egregious kind. It's absolute stupidity of the highest order. If Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney and Catherine's opponent had a chat about an idea and one of them had said, listen, that's a very good idea, we need to mention it to the Taoiseach, we need to mention it to Eamon Martin, and of course there'll have to be a competition for the post. You okay with that, Catherine? She'd have got the job without a shadow of a doubt. If they wanted her to get the job, she'd have got the job properly and appropriately. You seek expressions of interest, she'd have got the job, there'd have been no controversy.
Well, now we're in the middle of a huge row about freedom of information. Because there's all this discussion and this inference that this should always be the sort of role that is advertised. And of course, in principle, pretty much any significant role, no matter how large or small the pay packet that goes with it, ought to be advertised. But are special envoys and the whole area of diplomacy not the sort of thing for which there maybe ought to be a bit of discretion, where the government says this person is available and it would be to the nation's advantage for their time to be deployed?
All of our diplomats for the entire duration of our history as a nation have come from within the same department. It's the department that employs diplomats. And very, very few posts have been created outside that. You don't have to have an ad in the paper. You don't have to set up an interview board. You do seek expressions of interest. You do go public and you do say, look, we're interested in filling this. Would anybody appropriately qualified like to let us know? You go through a week or a fortnight and you make an appointment at the end of it in the simplest, most appropriate, most efficient way. And there's no controversy. There would have been absolutely no reference whatsoever to texts or tweets or freedom of information or anything. That's the first bit of it. It was entirely self-inflicted. The second bit of it is the public do care about it. I'm absolutely convinced of that, and I have evidence because I wrote a column about it 2 or 3 weeks ago in the Irish Examiner. My column goes on social media as a general rule, and I get reaction. I get reaction, good, bad, negative, etc. I've never got a reaction like this, never. I don't know exactly what it means, but there were 500,000 Twitter impressions of that column. 500,000 Twitter impressions. I've never got more than 100,000 before. And these were genuine, ordinary people. I got 1,000 comments, 3,000 or 4,000 shares. These are ordinary. They weren't the headbangers that you sometimes get on social media. And people were outraged by the smugness of it, the entitlement of it, the you know, the self-centeredness of it. They didn't care about the money. What they cared about was, like, who do these people think they are that they can divvy up stuff like this? So people were genuine. Now, that anger may have been replaced by boredom by now.
Yeah.
But at the time, people were genuinely angry, really, really angry about it. And it wasn't, therefore, a sort of a media bubble or a media made-up thing.
Yeah.
It was, there was genuine anger. And now you've got a situation where the Minister for Foreign Affairs, who has played a hugely important role in Ireland in the last 4 or 5 years, has been an asset to the country, is in the height of trouble. And he's in the height of trouble because he's been precious about it. Instead of saying, I made a dog's dinner at this and I'm really sorry, as you said, he's been saying, why,
so
what makes you feel entitled?
Isn't necessarily
to
what he says, but rather the way that he says it.
Well, there's a bit of that. And I mean, the least he has to do next week is be contrite. The least he has to do.
Do you think, by the by, and very mindful that you're talking to a current and a former employee of the journal.ie here, do you think that social media reaction is a good barometer of wider public interest?
It's a barometer. It's a barometer. And I think sometimes you can judge things by scale. I mean, if I get, you know, 1,000 reactions to column A and 50,000 reactions to column B, I'm guessing there's more public interest in column B than there is in column A.
It does speak to that in terms of it's that feeling of, you know, jobs for the boys or jobs for the girls again. Mm. And, you know, I think there's constantly been discussion and debate about this from Fine Gael to Fianna Fáil. Whenever they're in power or in opposition, they always hit out at the other for when instances
yes.
like this happen.
Yeah.
And then I think everyone sort of says, okay, well, now you're in, you're going to be
different. Yeah.
And then it turns out that
I recall having a very long row during an interview with the Taoiseach before Christmas about the appointment of Seamus Wolfe and how it was any different to the appoint of Moira Whelan. And we got very Jesuitical about how different it was.
Well, but I think the other thing that people really felt was a real strong sense of disappointment. Catherine de Bon has been and is a champion for the underdog in Ireland and has been a powerful advocate for people who, you know, have been oppressed, whether by reasons of gender or by reasons of poverty or by reasons of economic disadvantage. The work she and Anne-Louise Gilligan did in Talla is profoundly important work. And suddenly she comes across as entitled. And like, what's that about?
I was going to say, is that nearly the aspect of the text messages released this week, Christina, that are the most damning? Because there was the sense up until now that the government was, you know, that nobody had any vested personal interest in doing this, that it was just an appointment that would be good for all sides. It would be good for spreading Ireland's, you know, global values on a global stage at the United Nations. And then you see a text from Catherine de Bon texting her former Taoiseach, the now Taoiseach, going, I thought I was going to get this job. Why haven't I got this job yet? Have you heard anything? Which doesn't quite portray the same attitude.
Yeah, and I think that the text messages that were released, it sort of showed the informality of it, you know, that it was very much the, hey, have you heard about this job that I'm getting? When will I hear more about it? And like, in fairness, Leo Varadkar writes back very... nope. Like, I think everyone was sort of surprised, perhaps.
Even the flurry of excitement over the use of the word piglet, which
That was a wild 5 or 10 minutes on Twitter before we realised that piglet isn't some sort of
nickname,
self-referred, you know, porcine moniker around
at
Temple Bar wine venue.
Exactly. I was a bit worried when I saw that myself, that I didn't know everyone was very that close in the last government. But yeah, I do think, you know, it's come across
like the Secret Service code name or something. The
yeah,
eagle has landed.
About.
Piglet is in the wine bar.
But I do think she, as you said, she's had a very good reputation, and now it's kind of coming back to this sort of air of entitlement, and back again to people, ministers constantly coming out saying she was the best person for the job. Fair enough. Like, if she definitely was, Ireland is world renowned for its human rights aspects and all the championing that we do. This country is filled with people that I'm sure no doubt would give their left arm to be given a UN envoy. It's not something to be, laughed at. And even though I know the money perhaps isn't, you know, going to, it's 12,000 euro or so. It's a lot of money, though, still for a very important job for a lot of people.
It's nearly more the title and the prestige that come with it, I suspect, rather than the money
huge
itself.
Huge prestige attached to something like that. I mean,
and there was a lot of talk about she lived in New York, so it would have been easy that she would have been there. But sure, I'd say there's a lot of people that would be tempted to fly off and get some digs in New York to get a UN envoy job.
I'm going to regret asking this, but on that note of Secret Service names, if you have any suggestion for Secret Service nicknames for myself, Christina Finn or Fergus Finlay, on the record NT is the hashtag 53106 for your text. And although it might be forgotten because, God, 5 days is a long time in politics, this was the week in which the government announced that from October the 20th, effectively all COVID-19 restrictions are going to be lifted, with the sole exception of the requirement to wear masks in certain settings like retail and healthcare. Christina Finn, there is quite a lot written in today's papers. Where do you want to start?
Yeah, thank God we're actually talking about some good news about COVID over the last number of months, and that it was actually further down the agenda of current affairs discussions. But I think there's a lot talked about, a bit, you know, optimistic as well. And I think there's some interesting pieces about the rise in cases and where we're at and why we're seeing the rise in cases. And I think that's sort of what people are discussing maybe out and about is, you know, we've hit this high vaccination rate, but they're continuing to see the very high figures and what that sort of means for us going forward. I think over the next while, it'll be interesting to see what the focus is on from government in terms of where they're putting the spotlight. Is it, they're very much saying that hospitalizations, ICU numbers are, you know, the data we should be looking at. But we're going to obviously see a huge peak perhaps in September. What does that mean? And I think people are sort of questioning as well. They're probably hearing people being close contacts to people who have, and they don't have to isolate. So we've kind of moved into this whole...
Which you don't anymore. If you're fully vaccinated and you're a close contact, you're not expected to isolate. But you isolate until you get a test of your own, but you don't have to sit out the full fortnight.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's great that we're moving into this space. But I think there does need to be clarity as we're moving into October, that when we see perhaps there's talk of new variants, that the frighteners really aren't putting people as we're heading in, into winter, and just a clear path of where we're at. Because I think if we move into the narrative of discussing the high peak, there needs to be clear explanation from public health experts, government, about what exactly that means. Because there are still a lot of people out there that are cautious and wary. Obviously, there's on the flip side people that are just happy to get on with things. And I think the government now, I think, has a difficulty perhaps in striking that balance in terms of appeasing everybody. But obviously, as we head into winter, there needs to be, I think, a clear plan of how we're going to manage things.
Yeah, there's two ways that you could look at this, Fergus. And I spoke to the Taoiseach for Virgin Media News during the week, and I sort of put this to him that if you relax all restrictions by the end of October and you sort of accept that 90% of adults is the ceiling of what you're going to be able to do, that you're leaving hundreds of thousands of adults without the protection of vaccines, and you're going to allow the virus effectively to flourish again in society if there's basically no restrictions on where you can go. And you could argue that that's a really reckless thing to do in one sense. But then the flip side, which he put back to me, was aside from the need for people to feel like they're getting going again, and aside for the return of the economy, what more can you do? If the state has already offered full vaccination to every adult who is capable and desiring to get one, then what more can you do other than to decide, well, we've put up as much of resistance as we can, and now's the time to get back to life?
If you're double vaccinated, you can still get COVID, but you shouldn't get too sick. If you're not vaccinated, if you've chosen not to be vaccinated, you can still get COVID and you can end up in ICU or dead. And that's something that people ought to get and understand. Case numbers are not affected by vaccination. What is affected by vaccination is how sick people get when they get COVID. Any of us, we're all vaccinated. Any of us could get COVID tomorrow. But luckily and hopefully, we won't get too sick with it and we won't need to go to hospital. But I cannot understand. I just cannot understand the mentality of somebody who says, "I to hell with the vaccine. I'm not bothering. My back's out getting the vaccine," and expecting the rest of us to protect them. We don't have a choice here. We have to sort of try and get things going again. I mean, the level of frustration among people, and now, unfortunately, the level of risk that people are going to have to run to some extent. Last year, last winter, for example, almost nobody in Ireland got the flu because of social distancing.
There was literally no diagnosed flu at all.
And so on. This year, because there's less social distancing, more people are going to get the flu and are going to find themselves in hospital with, you know, serious flu complications.
Wearing your HSE director's hat, and I know there's only ever a limit to what you can say publicly without sort of going through the board first, but how much of a concern is that for the HSE that if you have even a far less significant spike than in the second or third waves of COVID hospitalizations, plus the return of flu, plus any other respiratory conditions going around, that it could make for a very difficult winter?
Well, I think the probability is that we're going to have a difficult winter. The HSE needs every ICU bed it has, and it probably needs more than the ICU beds it has, not for COVID, but for flu complications, for heart complications, for strokes, all the illnesses that people get. And every ICU bed that's occupied by a COVID patient is an ICU bed that is not available to somebody else. So, yeah, it's going to be tough. It's going to be difficult. I mean, I think, I suppose I have a vested interest in saying it, I think the HSE has pulled off in the last 2 years a miracle by getting through this pandemic without its ICU capacity being overwhelmed, without people having to be turned away from ICU when they needed it. Well, I think that has been a small miracle.
Well, it has done that, but only by cancelling elective surgeries on a large scale thing so that you can turn operating theatres into ICU.
I was going to say that. Behind that, there's this pent-up demand for stuff. I mean, there are people walking around in considerable pain, people not able to sleep at night because they need a hip replacement operation. It's been put on hold for a year and a half and will probably stay on hold for a bit longer because of the pandemic.
What can the HSE do to try and get through that more quickly?
Well, those plans are in place and we're doing our damnedest to try and catch up. But there is a huge catch up to be done, an enormous catch up to be done. And that's why I think it is in some ways the height of selfishness and arrogance for anyone to think, I'm not getting a vaccine, I don't need a vaccine. Every vaccine you take, you're not putting yourself at risk, but you are potentially saving lives by other people's lives by being vaccinated. We can't force people to be vaccinated, but you know, the ideal here is kill the pandemic by getting everybody vaccinated. And until we do, we can't get the health system back to struggling with normal.
I think that, like, when you look at Ireland's vaccination rates, we've done quite a lot. I'd be probably more of a civil libertarian myself that I'm, you know, wouldn't be the type to talk down to someone that perhaps has an individual choice about their vaccination needs, but we have hit.
There are some people who cannot choose to get it either. There are some people whose conditions are so vulnerable, and they're the ones who have they're the ones who are in most jeopardy by.
Yeah, and I think sometimes they often get lost out from the narrative when we're talking about passes and COVID passes.
It's a very small number of people. It's a very particular number of people, and very particular steps need to be taken to protect them. Yeah. There's no doubt about that. But I'm a civil libertarian, a complete and total, always have been. But I think there's a civic duty involved as well. I think sneering at the vaccine and following conspiracy theories about the vaccine, refusing to educate yourself about the vaccine, I think is an abandonment of civic duty.
Yeah, I think we've got to the point, though, that we are hitting the 90% vaccine rate. And as Micheál Martin says, what more can we do? I think there is a bit more of a discussion maybe perhaps to be had next month about where we end up, because I do think there are concerns, as you said, about the health service and Micheál Martin, the Taoiseach, they've all come out to say, yes, the 22nd of October, that's the date. Mm. But there definitely is some scepticism within government about whether we'll actually be able to lift all those things, I think, on the date, depending where we are at with the health service, because they have said with all their speeches that it's caveated on where we find ourselves with the pressure. And as you said, there's that huge pent up pressure of where we are at with other illnesses being built up and where we end up with flu and all the rest and whether we can actually deal with it. So I think it will be very interesting to see about where we end up coming up to the end of October. Mm. Maybe, as Radker said, we'll have the greatest Halloween parties ever. I don't know.
Yeah.
But
a meaningful Halloween. Not a good idea.
This morning's vaccination figures, by the way, show that 88.9% of all people aged 16 and over are now fully vaccinated, and 87.8% of people that's 87.8% of people are fully vaccinated. 88.9% have had one dose, which means there's a difference of about 40,000 people who are still awaiting their second dose. I have to apologise that no texter has come in with a Secret Service code name for Christmas. Christina Finn. I'm desperately sorry. One person has suggested that a Secret Service name for Fergus Finlay could only be Fozzie Bear. I don't know how you feel about that.
Fine.
Someone, Tom That's Douglas of this parish says that whatever the Secret Service name for me is, it must include the word royal, which I assure you is not a, a view on my political stance, but rather the fact that I'm wearing a, an O'Neill's Devonish Nutrition
I think they could think of us together, Gavin, and call us Statler and Waldorf. How about that?
That could work. Ronan, by the way, gets in touch on Twitter to say it gets missed. It's about the Catherine's Poem point. The special envoy job entailed being an accredited diplomat with a diplomatic passport, and you'd be part of the Irish UN delegation with access to and participation in UN forums and events. It is a stepping stone to further multilateral jobs, which, when you put it alongside Catherine's Poem's eagerness to get the name on her business card, if you like, Christina, makes a little bit more sense.
Yeah, it wouldn't look too shabby on the old CV, I'd say, when you're going for your next gig, no doubt about it. I definitely think that's probably what it would have been viewed as for a lot of herself in terms of, but I think she probably would have brought a lot to the role. There's no doubt about it. But I suppose my concern is that we do have a lot of other perhaps genuinely qualified people within the human rights sector that equally could have done a good job.
Could this be the death of the special envoy as we know it, if every single appointment from now is going to be so controversial?
I think it was the birth of the special envoy, wasn't it? As well as the death. I don't know of any other special envoys we've had.
They'll be clamouring for a special envoy.
We do have a special...
Actually, it must be pointed out that I think Micheál Martin made a slip up at the press conference where he referred to it as the special envoy for freedom of information rather than the special envoy for the freedom of expression. All, when we actually do need one of those, I think.
That's where all the stories getting tied up in a neat little bundle, and it seems like a very sage point to draw a line under all of this. Fergus Finlay, columnist with the Irish Examiner and member of the HSE board, and Christina Finn, political correspondent with the journal.ie. Thank you both very much for coming into studio this week.
On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.